Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The new open enrollment period for Vermont Health Connect has been going on for around 2 weeks, and Governor Peter Shumlin says things are finally working well. He says 18,000 Vermonters have completed the renewal process for coverage in 2016, and he expects the remaining 12,000 people will finalize their plans by the end of the month.
And I'm pleased to report that it is going very, very well. That's very different from the last two times that we began open enrollment. So needless to say, I'm incredibly grateful to Vermonters for their patience in helping us get to where we are now. But clearly Vermont's decision to stick with its own website to pull people together and get tough things done is paying dividends for Vermonters.
How have state officials resolved many of the technical problems that have plagued Vermont Health Connect from the outset? And will small businesses ever get their coverage through Vermont Health Connect as mandated by state law? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Healthcare Reform Chief Lawrence Miller. Lawrence, great to have you back.
Good to be here.
You can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Your thoughts about Vermont Health Connect. Maybe you've had some good experiences. We'd like to hear about that. If your experience hasn't been so good, let us know as well. Do you think Vermont Health Connect has solved most of its pressing problems? 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. So, Lawrence, based on the information that was released earlier this week, this third open enrollment period for Vermont Health Connect is proceeding much better than the two previous ones. What's the difference? Why is it working now?
You know, we were able to complete a lot of the system development that had not been completed before last year. And it's just like night and day. The fact that changes can be processed automatically in the system, the fact that there's an automated passive renewal process instead of a manual intervention passive renewal process, these things are making a huge difference. And, you know, now we're at the point, as of yesterday, about 20,000 individuals have been checked out into their 2016 plan. And, you know, it took months to get to that point last year, not a couple of weeks.
So these 20,000 people, are they people who are signing up for the first time? Are they people who are renewing their policies?
You know, the vast majority of these are renewals. We're not seeing a lot of new traffic this year. I'd like to remind people that this is the open enrollment period. If people aren't insured, this is the time of the year where they can get insurance outside of a special enrollment period. That is, if you lose your insurance or other life changes happen, you have a child, you can get a special enrollment period and get covered. But this is the time of year where people who don't have coverage can get it. We know from the last household survey, there were about 25, 27,000 Vermonters that didn't have coverage, and about a third of those were eligible for Medicaid. And we're hoping to bring Vermont's uninsured rate down a little bit further. Second lowest in the country, tied with Massachusetts, and we'd like to finish the job.
So this open enrollment period ends January 31st. Folks should understand that. And if they want to sign up after the end of January, there have to be certain circumstances that they have to meet.
That's right. If they lost other coverage, moved into the state, there are qualifying events that can get you into insurance. And of course, Medicaid's open enrollment all the time.
So how does that work? If I'm a person who's signing up at Vermont Health Connect and it turns out that I'm Medicaid eligible, will the system tell me that?
That's right. If you check the box that says you would like to understand if you qualify for financial assistance, it'll then cue you to enter your income information, and then it'll produce the eligibility determination in real time. So you see exactly what you're qualify for in federal and state subsidies, or if you qualify for Medicaid, and it tracks you into the right enrollment.
And just to be clear, Medicaid has open enrollment all year long.
You know, if you're eligible for Medicaid, you can apply anytime.
Lawrence, there was a new report that came out this week that looked at some of the plans on various exchanges through the Affordable Care Act. And some of these policies have very high out-of-pocket costs. And if there's anything that we've heard from our listeners over the last 3 years, is that these out-of-pocket costs are really enormous. For a single person, they can be $6,600. For a couple, that's over $13,000. And people feel like, well, I'm paying, you know, a fair amount of money for my premium, and yet I'm on the hook for these huge out-of-pocket expenses. And the new report says, you know, a number of healthy people are looking at this and saying, I'm not going to bother with insurance. And aren't these healthy people the people that you need to have?
Well, you know, most healthy people can get a reasonably priced plan, and high deductible health plans are an appropriate choice for generally healthy people if they've got the savings to deal with high out-of-pockets in the year that they happen. You know, very few of us any given year have high medical expenses, and it's not the same people every year. But that's why we have insurance. So it is important to get coverage. And catastrophic plans are available for younger people who have very low health exposure. But having coverage is a critical part.
Why was it designed this way? A lot of people are shaking their heads and wondering, okay, the cost of paying for my premium might be about the same as it was before, but I was never saddled with these high out-of-pocket costs. Why does it have to be that way?
Yeah, these plan designs were set at the federal level, overall plan designs, and each of the metal levels has a set actuarial value, and the silver plan is the plan you need to be in if you want to get federal cost-sharing reductions. So it's an artifact of the way the Fed structured it, and it does require some careful shopping and thought about what's right for your family.
So you could qualify for federal subsidies and say, well, at least some of my premiums are not as high as they were before, but you're still got these huge out-of-pocket caps.
Well, if you also qualify for cost-sharing reductions, those caps will be modified to meet your capacity. And that's true with Vermont cost-sharing reductions as well. Vermont offers both premium assistance and additional cost-sharing reductions for people under, I think it's 350% of the federal poverty limit for their family configuration. And those can be really important. Those cost-sharing reductions can be even more important in a year when a family has high medical expenses because they limit your exposure to a manageable percentage of your income, or at least what an analyst, an economist, might think is a manageable percentage of your income. Obviously, that can be really dependent on what other expenses your family faces.
Let's go to our listeners and talk to Kevin in Cambridge. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Good. My question goes to the overall cost of this experiment and setting up this exchange. And, you know, I guess what I'm hearing is we're talking about, 30,000 people enrolling. And literally, the cost of setting this up and finally, apparently, if it can be believed, getting it right this year has been well over $100 million, has it not? And I recognize federal funds, but, you know, every time you hear federal funds, we're federal taxpayers, too. And I think a lot of money has been wasted on this. Maybe it's right now, but why is it, you know, I just don't feel like we hear real honest assessments of how it's gone.
So thanks for your call. I think it's important to remember that Vermont Health Connect, the project, has built an infrastructure that is not just for the 33,000 people who are on qualified health plans. If that was all it did, that would be tremendously expensive. But this is also the new Medicaid eligibility and enrollment engine. And, you know, we've got a couple of 100,000 people on Medicaid in the state of Vermont. We need to migrate away from the old access system. So what the state did, and this was a strategy that was determined by the previous administration, the Douglas administration, was to lay down a new Oracle Enterprise system to replace the operating system at the Agency of Human Services. And then when the Affordable Care Act came along, that federal funding was used to execute on that strategy. So now the incremental cost of adding other programs at the Agency of Human Services to that platform will be much, much lower than they otherwise would have been. So I think the caller's right. If all we were talking about is a shopping exchange for 33,000 qualified health plans, it wouldn't make a lot of sense. In the overall context of being able to appropriately manage eligibility and enrollment for what in Vermont is, a $1.5 billion medical program and a $3 billion overall agency budget, those costs look a little bit more in line.
Today on the program, we're looking at Vermont Health Connect and your experience, 1-800-639-2211. Our guest today, Healthcare Reform Chief Lawrence Miller. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Lawrence, Vermont was the only state in the country to mandate that individuals and small businesses go through the exchange to purchase their healthcare policies. But it's never worked for small businesses. We keep exempting them and allowing them to buy directly from the private health insurance carriers. Is it ever going to work for small businesses?
Well, let's be clear. We just set SHOP aside. We haven't
now,
been...
What is SHOP?
SHOP is the electronic interchange for small businesses. So it's not that it's never worked. We just didn't build it. It was put on a shelf while we stabilized the individual market. And what's working for Vermont businesses is being able to go direct to the carriers and buy the same qualified health plans that are available in the exchange. This means that the risk pool for small employers is bigger, and that improves pricing and it improves stability. So that was the main goal of having a unified qualified health plan risk pool in the state, is getting those numbers at a level where they're appropriate. Minimum essential coverage under the new regulations, there's just not a lot of differentiation available anymore among plans. So really having pools of insureds becomes really quite critical to managing costs. The other thing that's possible in this environment then is somebody has a plan through their employer. Because it's a qualified health plan with the same configuration as cost there as in the individual market, if they were to leave employment in the middle of the year, they could keep the same policy and transfer that to themselves in the individual market, which means they wouldn't have to start a whole new deductible.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Rosemary from Middletown Springs. Hi, Rosemary. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I have had to go through a series of changes with Vermont Health Connect due to my husband's changing work situation. I canceled my insurance, our insurance, in March, and then I needed to go back on, and I believe it was in the summer when I contacted them, and they still hadn't processed the cancellation from March. For some reason, my dental aspect of it has gone through, but I'm still waiting on the medical. And I've got an ally up there who's kept track of my case, has told me that I'm one of about 1,000 people that has been put on a list that receives something like an 834 error or something like that in the system that can only be handled by someone higher up. And he, the last time I spoke with him, he was going to move it on to them. That was 2 or 3 weeks ago. Still haven't heard anything. Still haven't gotten a bill. I'm very frustrated, and I feel like, how can I even apply with for the new year when I haven't even got this year settled and I've got bills pending that are supposed to be covered?
Let me give you my email address. It's lawrence.miller@vermont.gov. That's Lawrence with a W. And I'll ask somebody to take a look at that.
Lawrence, we've gotten other similar emails from Marcy after calling in May of 2015 to cancel our plan. We've continued to receive monthly two-page invoices for premiums we don't owe. In addition, we recently received a three-page renewal dated October 19th. We've been told to ignore these mailings, but it's hard to ignore the resources and wasted taxpayer funds.
Yeah, there's a lot of there's a large batch of terminations that were just processed and are in the midst of being processed, which will clean a lot of these out. Been very, very frustrating for a lot of people.
Let's talk to Anissa in Burlington. Hi, Anissa. What's on your mind today?
Hi there. I'm calling because I'm deeply disappointed in Vermont Health Connect. And as someone who very much supports a universal healthcare system, I had high hopes, but continue to feel let down from little things like there being no date on invoices, the web problems, hard time logging in. I forgot my password and needed to be emailed, and that did not work. But then to bigger problems as well, where I had two qualifying life events. My insurance that was from through my employer ended on October 31st, and I had a baby on October 20th. While spending September and October calling, trying to be prepared and have an insurance plan that would start promptly on November 1st, I've been let down, and still my family is without health insurance, not due to lack of trying.
Well, first of all, congratulations on the birth of your child, and please do send me an email, lawrence.miller@vermont.gov, and I'll have one of the Resolver team take a look.
And can you appreciate how frustrating this is for people?
Absolutely. It's incredibly frustrating, people have been dealing with it for a long time. What I do know is that the number of people who are having trouble is way, way down, and the amount of time that it takes to resolve them once they get to the right group, depending on whether or not it's a billing problem or an enrollment problem or an eligibility problem, once it gets to the right group, the amount of time that it takes to resolve it is much, much faster than it was. I mean, just a few months ago, we had a very significant backlog of cases. Now, over half of calls that are come in, if there isn't a pre-existing problem with the account, over half of all calls that come in are able to be processed while the person is on the phone. Average handle time is 10 to 12 minutes. Wait times are typically just a few minutes. But again, if a case has problems or if something's done incorrectly, it can be difficult to resolve.
We got this email from Stephen who says, usernames that contain non-alphanumeric characters, for instance, an email address, cannot be used to log in, yet new users are allowed to choose such usernames without warning and without the system validation during sign-up. They complete a lengthy and invasive identification verification process only to find out later they can't log into the account. Stephen thinks this is a structural flaw. Is he right?
Yeah, it was a structural flaw. I think in particular it was the use of an at sign that screwed up the I think it's called LifeRay, the part of the system that had a problem with that. So that did go on the defect list, and now users are blocked from using an at sign. That was something that was identified and dealt with. But there's a lot of those little things along the way, and it's that combination of little things that is that led to that massive level of frustration.
Today in the program, we're looking at Vermont Health Connect with Healthcare Reform Chief Lawrence Miller. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today we're looking at Vermont Health Connect and the open enrollment period. Our guest today is Healthcare Reform Chief Lawrence Miller. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Let's turn to Kevin, who is calling from Williston. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What's on your mind today?
I was calling to share an experience that's very similar to the previous callers. I also lost my coverage at the end of last month in a job change. Starting almost exactly a month ago today, I tried to get insurance through Vermont Health Connect, and I'm still working with them to try to get that coverage. There's been technical glitch after technical glitch, I have a wife who is pregnant and having to see the doctor, and we're concerned whether or not we're going to have to pay those bills out of pocket since we don't have coverage right now. One of the things that I'll cut to the chase a little bit with the in trying to navigate this Kafkaesque bureaucracy. Mr. Miller mentioned that you have to get to the right department. One of my experiences is I'm constantly having to be escalated to the eligibility department, which is almost constantly having meetings, and then I'm told that they'll call me back in a few hours, and it's usually a 4 to 5 hour turnaround on getting a call back from that department. And the last thing I'll add is that as a computer geek, I'm a chief technical officer for a programming company, and the website is despicable. Simple things like, you know, sorting comments by date aren't done correctly. It's clear that not a lot of polish and concern was put into the website.
Yeah, well, I would say that the amount of time that was put in advance of development, given the federal deadlines, was clearly impossible. And I think we see that at exchanges throughout the country. It was fundamentally not an acceptable or reasonable schedule for development. And there's a lot that remains to be done in all of these systems. And the priority has been on basic functionality rather than the enhancements to usability that would make things admittedly much, much better. We've got a list of enhancements that should be made and will be when the basics are in order. But the priority has certainly been to stabilize things. And I think any time we've got somebody both with an eligibility issue and an access to care issue with a medical condition like whether it's an acute medical condition or a favorable medical condition like pregnancy, those access to care issues, we do have a way to respond to and get them escalated. So if the caller would like to reach out for me, I'd be happy to make sure that they're in the right path.
You know, I find it very interesting that you give our callers your personal email. So here's Kevin in Williston with a problem. And very concerned about his wife who's pregnant, and are they going to be responsible for all these bills? So if Kevin writes you, you're going to look into this personally?
I'm going to send it to one of the Resolver group and track it until it's noted. I mean, these are really, by the time they get to a call like this, these are people who are really frustrated with real-life issues around accessing medical care. We take all those really seriously. I mean, my email's on the web, my phone number's in the employee directory, and that calls straight through to my cell phone. I mean, this is stuff that's very, very important to people in their lives in critical situations. And, you know, whether it's somebody sitting at a pharmacy trying to get their prescription filled when the computer says they don't have coverage, or somebody who's got a pregnancy and needs to access appropriate neonatal care, it's critical stuff. So, yeah, we want to make sure that when people get in touch that they get to the right spot.
Let me ask you about Medicaid. Medicaid in the current fiscal year is running an almost $40 million deficit. Next year it's projected to be $60 million at least. The program was expanded under the Affordable Care Act. Is this a matter of you didn't make the right projections for how many people were going to come into the program, or are we looking at perhaps higher utilization than you anticipated, or both?
Sure. I think there's a couple of drivers looking at it, and I was not yet involved with all of the healthcare stuff when those projections were made. But looking back at how the projections were made, the total number of people who came into the exchange is about the same as what was projected. The difference between whether or not they were Medicaid eligible or eligible for qualified health plans was what was different. I think one of the drivers is the new eligibility rules under expanded Medicaid were done using the federal definition of modified adjusted gross income. And that's just not something Vermont has used in its tax forms or in its benefit programs or anything else. And I don't think that the folks working on the forecast got a really good picture of who would wind up eligible given that new rule set. And so there were a few more people eligible. So the caseload's up a little bit. There's some utilization that's up a little bit. That's not entirely unexpected. When people first get insurance after a few years, we might have some deferred maintenance, so to speak. And then there's a few other drivers. There's one new drug that's a significant part of that difference in the current budget adjustment. But, you know, we will deliver an appropriate budget adjustment act that adjusts things across budgets within state government without requiring new money. And we'll deliver a balanced budget for January.
Now, House Minority Leader Don Turner is calling for a top-to-bottom review of Medicaid. He claims there are people on Medicaid who are making in excess of $100,000 a year, but that the state is really not looking at the eligibility determination very closely. Is he right?
He would not be right about looking at the eligibility determination in the first instance. When people apply, their eligibility determination is reviewed against information on the Federal Data Hub. So it's actually looking at their most recent IRS filing. It's looking at their Social Security number, incarceration. It validates across a whole range of things. What is important to remember about the MAGI Medicaid determination, the economic determination under the new rules, is that it doesn't look at what was your income last year as well. It is sort of focused on what is your income now. And so we do need to go through and begin the redetermination of eligibility process, and that begins in January for the income-eligible population. The age-blind and disabled population is in redetermination right now. And we'll identify those that are inappropriately enrolled, and those are taken off the rolls.
So is it possible that someone with a salary of $100,000 could be on Medicaid right now?
If they are, then shame on them. They're required to report income changes. And they're required to inform the state if they're no longer eligible for Medicaid. The redetermination process, that's a regular annual process, that got deferred a little bit, but it's restarting, is only to catch those. But if he knows somebody who's makes $100,000 a year and is on Medicaid, I'd like to know that, and our fraud, waste, and abuse people would like to know that.
So as you look ahead to the next fiscal year and a deficit of at least $60 million, and you said we're going to have a balanced budget, does that mean that either A, some of the eligibility requirements are going to have to be tightened up, or B, the benefit package is going to have to be reduced?
You know, I'm not going to project what the governor's recommended budget will be at this point. But there's a lot of difficult choices to be made in the current environment. The budget gap for Medicaid is just part of the total picture of state spending, and we'll come forward with a balanced budget recommendation, and then the legislature will do its work to sort out the priorities in state government and figure out what we fund, what level, and that's going to be a heavy lift for the legislature this year.
I mean, some people would say if you're going to restrict eligibility somewhat, or if you're going to cut back on the benefit package, you haven't really solved the problem. You've just moved it to another part of the budget.
You know, and I think that's something that people lose track of with the Medicaid expansion. They think of these as new costs. They're not new societal costs. We have in this country for a long time said that you're not going to get turned away from an emergency room. So you add people to Medicaid. It's not that they've got a whole bunch of new health experiences that need to be paid for. These were part of what was paid for in the system overall before they came on Medicaid. Now they're paid through an organized system. People have access to primary care that helps avoid other acute care. And the federal government shares in the expense instead of having all of it come out of the Vermont economy. I think the Medicaid expansion is very significant and very, very positive for the state. The fact that we've had an adjustment in that population on a one-time basis means we need to make some decisions about what the funding level is going to be and how that relates to other things we fund in the state. But it's really critical that we got a lot of people who weren't previously covered. And that means they can get primary care. That means they can get better care. We've heard from a couple of people today about pregnancies, get better care when they're pregnant, which produces better outcomes for the kids and lowers costs overall.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Bill in Colchester. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks. Thank you for talking to me. My comments were on the macro level, and here's my experience. Before the Affordable Care Act, I'm self-employed. I bought my insurance on the open market, and I had two choices, MVP and Blue Cross Blue Shield, and I bought through MVP. After the Affordable Care Act, there's still two choices on the market, MVP and Blue Cross Blue Shield, and the only change I saw was my premium went up by 3 times. And that really, really frustrates me. I hear people say, oh, this is great, I have coverage now, so on and so forth. I would argue a few things. First, people chose not to have coverage, and now they do because people like myself are subsidizing it. And people like myself who are responsible got really penalized by the Affordable Care Act. And I just don't understand why the state of Vermont doesn't get smart and scrap our own exchange and go to the federal exchange. I'll wait to hear your comments.
And Bill, just so we know, how do you think moving to the federal exchange would be beneficial for you?
Because I'd have more choices. And also, all this nuance with how the frustration, everyone who's called, which I experienced the same challenges with trying to make our exchange work. The federal exchange works out. My brother lives in New Hampshire. He's on the federal exchange. New Hampshire spent, like, I think, $10 million to ramp up to the federal exchange. The state of Vermont has spent $100 million. And I just don't understand why we don't get smart. We're a state of 650,000 people. We're trying to manage a huge project. We need to be a little jockey riding a big horse. And we have this exceptionalism in Vermont that we're smarter than everyone else, and we're going to figure it out on our own. And you know what? We're not. We're too small a state to carry this burden by ourselves.
All right, Bill. Interesting question. Lawrence, why not go to the federal exchange? Well, wouldn't that solve some of these problems?
We just published fairly lengthy report, really doing a detailed cost-benefit analysis of alternatives to Vermont Health Connect, and that's available on the website of the Joint Fiscal Office, who reported to the legislature. There's a key thing that's missing on the federal exchange, which is Medicaid eligibility and enrollment. It isn't there. So we would still need to have a system, the Vermont Health Connect system, that deals with MAGI Medicaid eligibility and enrollment. By having this part of one system, it seamlessly helps Vermonters find the best coverage that's appropriate for them, whether it's a qualified health plan or in a Medicaid, and in our case with Dr. Dinosaur, mixed households being able to access Dr. Dinosaur for eligible kids. And actually going to the federal exchange in order to do that, as well as the qualified health plans, would be more expensive because of our need to then have two different systems operating. There's also a very significant fee at the federal exchange. 3.5% doesn't sound like much in a premium tax, but on the net premium for subsidized individuals, that can be as much as 30% of the net insurance premium that they would pay.
Let's talk to Bill in Killington. Hi, Bill. What's on your mind today?
Hi, good afternoon. I'm going on my third year of being on the system, and I had a successful experience buying my product on the web, so that's good. However, I buy insurance to have the peace of mind that I'm covered, and we pay a lot for it, but be that as it may, every month for the last 2 years, I receive a bill, an invoice that says, hey, you're not paid. And each time I call and I say, wait, I paid. Look, I paid electronically through my bank, and I know it's paid. The very nice people on the phone, which I'll give you great marks on telephone etiquette from everyone I've spoken to, which has been way too many people. They are extremely nice. So it's really hard to get angry at them. But their response to me is, oh, don't worry about it. You're covered. That doesn't give me the peace of mind I want, which is the reason I'm buying insurance. It feels a bit like if invoicing is this difficult, which I would argue might ought to be the easiest part of this entire program to administer, where are we supposed to get the confidence that it's really being done right and it's more than just creating more government jobs for people to solve the problem?
Okay, Bill, we're almost out of time, but Lawrence, we've gotten a couple of emails, the same kind of situation. I'm paying these premiums and people are telling me that I don't have coverage.
The Dunning report that runs, that goes to the carriers, runs at the end of the month. And if a payment is in transit, they can get a termination notice that is shipped before their premium is processed. And that's always going to be a fundamental problem. Looking at a couple of different ways of realigning the billing system and the premium processor and the handling of grace periods, because it isn't optimal right now.
I want to mention here at the end of this segment that the open enrollment period does end January 31st, so folks need to sign up by that date. Lawrence Miller is the chief of healthcare reform in the Shumlin administration. Lawrence, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you, Bob.
Coming up next, I'll talk with Paul Heintz, a political columnist for 7 days, about a very busy week in political news in Vermont. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. It's been a very busy week for politics in Vermont. House Speaker Shap Smith dropped out of the governor's race. The issue of resettling Syrian refugees in Vermont emerged as an issue in that race. And also, Senator Bernie Sanders delivered a key speech outlining what it means to be a democratic socialist. With us now to discuss these and other issues is Paul Heintz, who writes a political column for 7 days. Paul, thanks for being on the program.
Good to be here, Bob.
So, Paul, let's start off with the governor's race. Shap Smith announced this week he was suspending his campaign because of his wife's health. Tell us about this situation.
Well, this is obviously really sad news, and it kind of reminds everybody of what a small political family we have here in Vermont. You know, I think it's been known for some time in Montpelier that Speaker Smith's wife, Melissa, had been diagnosed with breast cancer, you know, I think everyone was optimistic that that he would be able to remain in the race, but the family got a little bit more news last week, it sounds like, and the speaker decided that he really needed to spend more time with his family and be more available during this coming year, and so he suspended his campaign. He did make clear that it was highly unlikely that he would get back into the race, and certainly this changes a lot of things. He did say that he would remain speaker through the coming legislative session, but that he would not run for re-election to his House seat, which he had made clear before.
Well, we certainly wish Shap and his wife, Melissa, the very best in her recovery. Paul, now that leaves us with two candidates in this race, former Transportation Secretary Sue Minter and former Windsor County Senator Matt Dunn. How does Shap dropping out of this race affect the dynamics now of this contest?
Well, I think it certainly affects them quite a bit. I think most people saw all three candidates as very strong, perhaps equally strong. And Speaker Smith obviously has played a major role in state government for the last number of years, so he had many advantages in this race. It's a little bit unclear how precisely this will affect the field. People, rightfully so, were being very cautious about talking too much about the political dynamics here. But you know, I've heard from a number of people that they think Sue Minter probably ends up picking up much of Speaker Smith's support. They're sort of both in the same lane of more insider types, who have been, the Speaker has, of course, run the legislature for the last little bit, and Sue Minter was in the Shumlin administration. Matt Dunn has been running as more of an outsider. So I think that it's likely that Minter will pick up some of the Speaker's support. But I think there's also the possibility that another candidate could get into the race at this point. We don't really know at this point, although a former state senator, Peter Galbraith, has mentioned that he is interested in potentially joining down the road.
Paul, we also saw this week that the issue of resettling Syrian refugees in Vermont emerged as an issue in the gubernatorial race. Roughly 31 governors across the country said that they would oppose having any refugees come to their states at this time until there's greater national security. Most were Republicans, but New Hampshire Governor Maggie Hassan was in that group. In Vermont, Governor Peter Shumlin said he was open to having some refugees. He was very critical of governors who are restricting access, and at the same time, two Democratic candidates, Sue Minter and Matt Dunn, agreed with Shumlin. But we saw the two Republicans in this race, Phil Scott and Bruce Lisman, having a very different point of view. They want to put this resettlement plan on hold until security questions have been worked out at the national level. Are you surprised at all by these responses?
Well, you know, it's been a fascinating week. This issue has touched every political system in the country, and certainly the rhetoric in Vermont has been different than elsewhere. It's been a little bit more subdued. I was a little bit surprised, I have to say, by the responses given by the Republican candidates. As you note, Lieutenant Governor Scott said he wanted to take a pause, was the words that he used, and Bruce Lisman said that he wanted to take a step back from admitting Syrian refugees. I think what's interesting here is, just from a political perspective, is that Phil Scott has really worked hard to distance himself from the National Republican Party. And, by sort of agreeing that we should perhaps step back from admitting Syrian refugees, I think he provided an opportunity for Democrats to really connect him to national Republicans. And that's something that Matt Dunn certainly did. I spoke with him yesterday, and he was very, very critical of Lieutenant Governor Scott. He said he was disappointed in him, and he said that's, basically not the kind of thing that we stand for here in Vermont. It's hard to see exactly how this will play out. Certainly, if you look at just the comments under any news story that's been published in Vermont over the last couple of days, people feel very strongly about this issue, and they feel very strongly on both sides of it. We haven't seen any polling, so it's unclear where exactly the majority in Vermont stands. But I think the Democrats seem to think that they're on the winning side of this issue politically. The state party put out a statement today criticizing Phil Scott for his statements.
Paul, yesterday afternoon, Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders gave a much-anticipated speech about what it means to be, quote, a Democratic socialist. He said the goals of being a Democratic socialist are right in line with the New Deal policies of FDR and a decision by Lyndon Johnson to push for Medicare in the 1960s. Here's part of what Sanders said.
In other words, real freedom must include economic security. That was Roosevelt's vision 70 years ago. It is my vision today. It is a vision that we have not yet achieved, and it is time that we did. And in my view, the billionaire class must be told loudly and clearly that they cannot have it all, that our government belongs to all of us, not just a handful of billionaires.
The crowd there at Georgetown University very enthusiastically supporting Bernie Sanders. Paul, why did Sanders feel it was necessary to give this speech in the first place?
Well, about a month ago, Senator Sanders started saying that he was going to deliver the speech. He said that a lot of people get really scared, worried when they hear the word socialist. And so he wanted to explain what this really means to him. In the month since, many people have sort of compared this to John F. Kennedy's speech on his Catholicism, Mitt Romney's on his Mormonism, and Barack Obama's on his controversial pastor, sort of big issues that are talked about quite a bit and really seem to resonate with voters that politicians really want to address and explain. So, you know, this speech came together yesterday. And what was really striking is that, you know, instead of sort of talking about Scandinavian countries, as he often does, or Eugene Debs, you know, he really tried to wrap himself in Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he spent quite a bit of time talking about Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights, making clear that what he stands for is not as radical as his critics might suggest, that all he's really calling for is, you know, the right for decent pay, for food, for education, for healthcare, that sort of thing. You know, so I think that his speech definitely explained it. The question is whether anyone was listening. It was, you know, an hour and 8 minute long speech. You know, he was very animated. He was very forceful. This wasn't someone who was apologetic. He was definitely defending his philosophy here in very strong terms. So I don't know how it will actually play with your average voter who is concerned about his democratic socialism from the first place.
Paul Heinz writes a political column for 7 days. Paul, many thanks for being on the program today.
Great to be here. Thanks, Bob.
That is Vermont Edition for today. On Monday, the debate over refugees in the week since the Paris terrorist attacks. Questions of security have been at odds in the debate with humanitarianism over whether to accept refugees from the Syrian civil war. That's Monday on Vermont Edition. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sangari and Sam Gale Rosen with production assistance from Hannah Kearns. Mary Williams directed the program and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.